Hi, and welcome to Nashville Public Radio's podcast where we talk to some of the most interesting people in the city. This is episode 2 of Movers and Thinkers. I'm your host, Emily Seiner. And yes, you heard me correctly. It's movers and thinkers, not movers and shakers. That is perhaps the more common phrase, but the people we interview aren't necessarily shaking the city. They're not the most powerful people in Nashville or the people who are quoted on a regular basis in news stories, but they are leaders in their own fields and thinking of new ideas. And in this episode, I got to pick the brains of people who are thinking about something very important, how to make our city and region a better place. I call them Nashville's Fixers. We taped this show in WPLN Studio C in June. Tasha Lemley is a social entrepreneur who co-founded Nashville's homeless newspaper, The Contributor. You may have bought a paper from their vendors on the side of the road.
We were selling something we didn't know we were selling. We were selling human interaction.
Kassar Abdullah is a Muslim American activist who tries to stem conflicts when people say hateful things about her religion.
So many of the audience who actually came said, oh, I just came because I was told you guys are terrorists. I had no idea you guys were so nice and we were so rude.
And Ron Johnson leads a program at the Oasis Center for teenage boys caught up in the justice system. The kids go to his program instead of juvenile detention. He explains he can identify with them because he grew up in the projects in Memphis. He was the fifth of 10 boys.
I was that fifth kid that one felt like the black sheep, which I am the darkest in the family. But at the same time, I was the one that stayed in trouble a lot. So I remember a story that was just so amazing to me. I was in the fourth grade playing in the sand, but I would look up at the airplanes as they would pass over the projects we lived in, and I would make little statements like, you know, one day I'm going to fly all over the world, and I'm going to play pro football, and I'm going to buy my own airplane. And my two friends, who I thought was like my sand buddies in the sand pit, laughed at me. And so that really did something to me. I mean, there was a drive inside of me after that moment, that day particularly. I kept saying to myself every day we would play, never told him about it, I'm gonna show them. And so I grew up with that drive, and that kind of got me started on knowing without a doubt, you know, as long as you have the drive in you, no matter what things happen to you, you can, you know, be successful.
But in the 1990s, his penchant for trouble took over. He was charged with possession of 237 pounds of weed and 50 kilos of cocaine. He ended up with 4 years in federal prison.
That was my epiphany moment. I started to replay all of my life. And I looked at that film and said, wow, I didn't like a whole lot about that. I didn't want to see other young people such as myself experience what I've experienced, because I think in this day and time it wouldn't make it through. So that's where I knew then that I wanted to do something about it. And came out on June 1st, 1998, and dedicated my life to being a change agent. And here we are.
Kassar Abdullah grew up thousands of miles away, but her childhood was also quite formative.
So at the age of 6, I actually fled Kurdistan of Iraq due to the war that Saddam Hussein engaged with Kurdish people in an attempt to basically ethnically cleanse that area. And so as a child, I fled by foot to Turkey. And I remember, just like many other children, when you are young, one of your favorite words is why. So I constantly bugged my mother, you know, why did we leave? Why am I here? Why can't we go back? Why do they hate us? That was my favorite question. I let those questions settle for a while until, I think it was like 1992. I was about 10 years old. We were taken from the refugee camp and actually settled in Fargo, North Dakota. Don't ask me why, out of the 50 states in the United States, they put us in the snow. Unfortunately, it was 1995 when Oklahoma City bombing happened, and I was in middle school, and at the beginning, you know, the images that showed on the media were Muslims. I was actually attacked, and I felt quite vulnerable. So basically, these were some personal experiences that really became, you know, strength for me to better understand human behavior. What I firmly believe is every time we tend to be ignorant about any human or any subject, we tend to have this fear inside us. So I wanted to make sure that no one fears me as they walk by me.
Tasha.
Yes.
What was the moment when you knew that you wanted to work with homeless people?
It kind of slipped up on me. I was looking for my place in Nashville. I moved here in 2002. I was hoping to make a living as a graphic designer and had a bunch of interviews. I thought they went great. And the only person that offered me anything was Kinko's. And right behind it, there's a tiny parking lot. You park there, walk to the door. So I would do that every day, walk from my car to the door, car to the door. And one day I was driving into work and I realized, you know, I've seen the same homeless man on that bench between the parking lot and the door every single day. If he was a, quote, normal person, we would have introduced ourselves to each other long ago. Like if I saw you every day at Starbucks, eventually, a couple weeks, it wouldn't take that long before I'd be like, do you work around here? You know, what's up? But this man, because I didn't perceive him on the same level as myself or because I perceived him as an other, we never introduced ourselves to each other. And so that day, I think, just kind of reaching a point of desperation and trying to figure out, is my life really meant to be at this Kinko's? I thought, I'm going to do something really radical. I'm going to introduce myself. I'm going to say hi. And so I walked up to him and I stuck my hand in his face and it startled him. He looked up and we shook hands and started getting to know each other.
She started taking photos of homeless people for the Metro Housing Agency.
Really fell in love with this community. I think through my own soul searching, found that this must be a community that knows some things that I don't know. I think I grew up privileged, white in the South, to look at the man sitting on the bench. Literally, this was a man named Don sitting on the bench and think, he's got to know something I don't know. What gets him through the day? What keeps him moving? What keeps someone that's under such tough conditions, what keeps you going? Started to meet people, getting to know them, and wanted to be in that community somehow, but kind of hadn't earned my cred, didn't have the street cred. I had not been homeless. And I was aware of street newspapers in other communities, and I thought, well, that'd be a fun side project. You know, it'd be great to have a homeless newspaper. The Scene won't hire me. The Tennessean's not interested in me. So I guess I'll make my own paper. So I did. I got the right people together in a room and built the Contributor and launched it at the end of 2007. And so I don't know that there was ever a very specific time where I felt like I want to save homeless people or even work with the homeless community. But it was just a community I wanted to be a part of. And I had to figure out how to get my in.
And can you explain, because I'm sure a lot of people don't know, like, how does the Contributor work?
So the Contributor contracts with homeless or formerly homeless individuals. Every paper then is purchased up front by the person selling the paper. So none of the money that's given to a vendor on the street for that purchase, that doesn't come back to the paper. That stays with that individual. And then they keep that entire income plus any tips above and beyond, which can be really substantial.
Ron, can you talk about what you do? So, like, what's the premise of the REAL program and why does it work?
Well, the REAL program, it stands for Reaching Excellence as Leaders. We are the only alternative to the detention program in the state of Tennessee. What they do, instead of sending them to juvenile, they send them to us. And our job is to redirect. Our theme is, what can we do to help you? Because we can't do it for the young people or for anyone. But if we can help you, or help you discover what it is inside of you, I think we can make a difference.
But how do you do that?
We meet young people where they're at. I know it sounds cliche. We start off with this piece we do called lyricology, studying how music affects us and how it drives a lot of the things that we do and say. That's where we begin, not to denigrate the music that they listen to or we listen to, but to help them appreciate it and navigate it better. So that's where we find ourselves starting. And then from there, we roll into anger management, trauma. We see that all the young people come to us. They've been hurt. They've been injured, but they've never had any place to really heal.
I mean, how do you do that? How do you change someone's outlook on the world?
Well, here's one of the things that we do more than anything is we set a mirror. Like you go to the weight room, you notice any of you guys that go and work out, you know, you may not look in the mirror when you first get there, but over time you start feeling yourself, you start really kind of liking yourself. So you look into the mirror. Well, most of our young guys, we find they don't look into the mirror. They don't really, the mirror that they see is what people say about them. That's their reflection of who they are. We have a tendency to believe that if we can get a young person to see himself for who they are, they can find what it is inside of them and then drive through it. And then I use a lot of my stories, and my stories and my experiences has been one that opened the door. First, they realize that you understand where they're coming from. Then they trust you. And then before you know it, you start getting called at 2 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Ron, need to talk to you. I'm like, bro, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. But it opens up an area where you can have a conversation with young people that they don't really have with their parents, and then they don't really have a man that they really can trust. You know, we deal with 98%+ of young African American boys who do not have a father or a positive male figure, African American male figure, in their life at all. It takes a man who have had some of those experiences to teach him that this experience doesn't define you. Then they change their own mind. It's just us creating conditions.
Kassar, you also work with changing people's outlooks. Can you talk about an instance when you faced a lot of hatred against Muslims and how you dealt with that?
Sure. There's a lot. But just one that actually recently happened here in Tennessee in Coffee County. Of course, the Coffee County Commissioner decides to put a Facebook ad that basically had a cowboy with a shotgun that winked and said, "This is how you wink at a Muslim." And so when I saw that, I was like, oh my goodness, he's calling death to me. You know, I thought this is definitely an opportunity to engage and have a conversation rather than for me to be angry and upset and make it worse. And so we called the commissioner up and had a conversation and said, we would love to meet with you. You know, over the phone, he basically said, it was just something funny and started, you know, laughing. And I said, I'm not laughing. I don't think it's funny, especially for an elected official. It is not funny. Do you know how many Muslims you have in your constituency? He was actually shocked that there are American Muslims who are born and raised for generations in his county. So we brought in the Muslim leaders, and particularly who lived in his county, and then brought him. And we sat down and have a conversation. And there were definitely some misconceptions, and he was misinformed about who are Muslims. And you know, towards the end, he said, you guys have to come back, and we need to do a public forum. And so we organized, you know, and had a presentation that basically talked about who are American Muslims in particular, you know, our history here, talked a little bit about our faith, and then the fact that there's no such thing as the Muslim community. It's a set of communities. We're quite diverse as well. Then we got contacted by law enforcement who said, I just want to let you know there's going to be a counter rally. Pamela Giller from New York is flying down here. She's got her posses. And you can either cancel this, you know, altogether, because we can't guarantee the safety for you guys. And so it was interesting, vast majority, I mean, across from generations of the Muslim community said, no, we must go. And again, it's an opportunity to have a dialogue. And so we did. And some of the most brutal conversations actually came out of there. To be quite honest with you, I mean, some of the most racist comments happened in that place. People shouting and saying, you know, death to Muslims, you know, we should burn every mosque. And, you know, you just sit there and you think and you're like, you know, okay, you know, how much more can I take in? At that moment, I actually feared how the young population would react that came with me, the young Muslim individuals, like how much more toxic can they take in and then evaporate it and still respond with peace? And I remember this one incident, an elderly woman came to me, you know, dressed really beautifully like she's going to the church, and she had a big Bible, and she sort of smacked it in my face. You need this? And I said, ma'am, I've actually read it. I still have a copy at home too. You know, King James Version, actually. And she just got shocked. You've read this book? And I said, yes. Actually, it's also next to my Torah, my Quran. And I went on and she said, this is the only book you will ever need. And I said, actually, I think you need other books as well. So many of the audience who actually came there as a result of Pamela actually organizing contacted and said, oh, I just came because I was told you guys are terrorists and you're this and this. So basically lots of misconceptions. I had no idea you guys were so nice and we were so rude. And we, you know, it was just things went so far. That moment, like I walked away much more energized and said, this is the way to fight hate.
Tasha, with your work, it's changing the ideology of everyone else as much as the people that you're actually working with. Like, homelessness has a stigma around it.
Yeah, when we founded the paper, the idea was we wanted to create a flexible source of income for people who needed it at that time in their lives and to create a publication that was well worth a dollar that would be informational. It's $2 now, but at the time it was a dollar. And the third part of the mission, you've already alluded to it, and Kassar's talking about it as well, it revealed itself to the staff. It was the face-to-face interaction between people who had experienced homelessness and those who had not. Just like me with Don, many people in Nashville had not had the opportunity or the excuse to dialogue with the person next to them. The newspaper and the model by which it sold created an excuse in the community. We were selling something we didn't know we were selling. We were selling human interaction.
Have any vendors actually gotten out of homelessness?
Many. You know, that was not what I went into it for. I, again, just wanted to create a source of income for people who needed it. It was pie in the sky to think that one day maybe somebody will get housing off of this. Wouldn't that be cool? And it didn't take long at all. I think that humans are incredibly resourceful. And given that tool, they ran with it. At the time I left, there was a 50% housing rate that people who had started the paper as homeless would get housing up 3-6 months later. Within no time, they would use that money for the things you would hope they would use that money for. I think the very first person that ever got housing was Ray Ponce de Leon, and he still writes for the paper occasionally. But if you happen to remember back in the day, we used to have some really weird comic strips that he would write. And he's also the guy that whenever he writes, he loves to compare, like, if Ronald McDonald were born in medieval times. And he'll come up with like 12 points, like 12 analogies, like if this fictitious character was born in this time period, what would that look like? That was a great pleasure to see someone that used the paper not only as a vocal for their humor and their self-expression, but also as a source of income that got him off the streets. And he's stayed off the streets for, it's got to be near 8 years now.
Ron Johnson's REAL program has also had some very moving success stories.
We had this young guy that just graduated from the group. We teach our young people, you know, the anger management. We talk about trauma. We talk about relationships. But we also teach them. I'm a certified CRM specialist, which is consciously resting meditation. So we teach them how to be quiet. Because our young people say, man, I can't be quiet, man. I can't be still. And so a lot of this has been programmed into these young people's head that, you know, they can't stop moving. They can't do this. They've been told that they can't do a bunch of different things. Well, this young person really took heart to that 20 minutes that we would take before and 20 minutes right there toward the end of what being quiet looked like. He was being raised by a single mom, and Alex said he would see his mom come in all the time. She was stressed out, and she didn't seem like she was never getting any sleep, and they would always fuss and argue all the time. And he started to tell his mom about this quiet time thing that he does. And so he asked her if she wanted him to teach her. So he taught his mother how to do CRM. And he said, man, his mama, she's been going to sleep and she hadn't been fussing and we hadn't been arguing. And he said he taught his girlfriend. And then he noticed that as he was talking with his grandmother, he said the same thing. It just felt like they were stressed out. And he taught his grandmother. And so now he has a collective group. His mom, his girlfriend, and his grandmom all know how to do CRM. One of the things that we really believe in is if we can teach a young person what change look like, he can teach another and so on and so on. It's like each one, reach one, teach one. Bring somebody up with you along the way instead of just kind of getting it and moving out and never coming back. And these guys, he took it to heart.
What is the rate in the program of recidivism?
Well, the national average of recidivism is about 55% or something like that. It's pretty high.
So that means that more than half go back.
More than half go back into the system. We have about 17% of recidivism. In other words, you know, if we get 100 young people, we're talking about maybe 17 of those young guys may find themselves back in trouble. And I don't think it's nothing special that we do other than that we specially love. We really believe in pouring out love, and it is contagious. I believe that with all that's in me, especially when you're talking about someone who haven't heard a man tell them, hey, bro, I love you, man.
But I would imagine there's also a lot of heartbreak.
Yeah, that right there, it touches me. Over the last 5.5 years or so, you know, I have been a part of about 25 funerals, and most of these guys were murdered. Each time I think about it and I would get these calls from their moms, it just breaks my heart that a mom and everybody else have tried to do all that they could, you know, to create the conditions to help a young person make the decision to go a different way, and they choose not to that's hard. I mean, it's really hard because you think that I've done all that I can. But here's the thing that I live by is you can't do it for them. They're not puppets. For some, unfortunately, we lose them. And just recently we lost one of the young guys.
Disappointment and even heartbreak, it comes with the territory of trying to make change. Kassar, in your role, when people don't respond, you don't feel like you've made a difference. How do you get through that?
I also just self-talk myself to say it's still their choice. Their choice to seek and have dialogue with me or learn or sort of get out of their fear. Then I actually feel bad more for them than I do for myself. Because I would hate for a human being to walk in ignorance or to be walking in fear out of another human being.
Tasha, you are the one in the group that didn't experience the problem that you're trying to solve. What can everyone else learn about working with people that you are not a part of?
You know, as we're all saying here, get to know the other. We're not that different. Even though I haven't experienced a state of not having a place to sleep at night, I no longer perceive someone different just because they have. I mean, of course, their experiences are different, but is a homeless person's experience different from mine any different than yours and mine are, or yours and mine? And I think there's so much power in getting to know the person next to you and getting to know our community and our neighbors.
You all are facing down these huge problems, like societal problems. As wonderful as your work is, like, you're never going to fix it. I mean, maybe that's me being cynical, but I, you know, these things will always exist. They have always existed.
Be more optimistic. Come on.
Okay. Well, so how do you deal? How do you keep going when, like, as much as you can do is still never enough?
I agree with you that, for example, we're talking about hate. I think in the society, there will always be hate. You know, there will always be ingredients that contribute to hate, ingredients that contribute to ignorance. What our nation is actually facing right now, in particular with the African-American community. I was truly shocked. I thought they came a long way. They're done with their struggles. It's time for mine. You know, I truly thought that. And then I began to realize there will always be racism. There will always be classism, sexism, you know, and all the other isms in the society. I don't think we can ever delete it. And maybe it's because we human beings are such simple-minded that we can never recognize love if there isn't hate, just like we can't really appreciate daylight if there isn't night. I think the struggle for us is to make sure that we don't fall into that darkness. One of the most dangerous diseases a human being can actually have is fear. I believe fear paralyzes the mind and the heart. And when your mind and your heart is paralyzed, there's not much to your life. And so we have to just be aware, call for what it is, really. Call it, label it, recognize it, and don't let it overshadow love.
Yes. We get asked how we do what we do and why we continue to do what we do, even after you are walking out of a funeral, you know. Even with all the heartbreak that I see with some of the young people that I've had to eulogize, I still know that there's hope. And with that hope, I believe that happiness is contagious. I believe that love is contagious, just like hate is contagious. We can really, literally love the hell out of somebody. And that's the whole key. We have so much more in common just being human beings than we have not in common. But most of the things that we do are completely what we've learned and what have been taught to us through the institutions and so on and so forth. We are who we are, but we can change it because we can change our minds and we'll change the direction of other people.
You know, there's the old preacher analogy about the kid walking down the beach throwing in the starfish, and you're never gonna save everybody, but it matters to that one, and it matters to that one. And I think it is contagious. I think if you take it a little further, those starfish are crawling back up on and helping someone else back into the water. If it can matter to the next person, if I help them back in the water too, then that's what I want to do. And I don't ever think there'll be an end to homelessness as long as humans are around. That's not a goal I aspire to, but it's just to make a difference to the next person.
We then opened up questions to the audience. The first question we got, how does art and music play into making change?
We took a group to Selma. for the 50-year anniversary. We gave all these guys a camera, and they all took pictures. We had one little guy. His name is Blessing, like straight up in the Bible, Blessing with I-N-G. And he is a little guy, so bold. He walked up right up to John Lewis and just, boom, right in his face. And we have a great big old picture of it, and it's beautiful. I mean, the art of that is just incredible. And that's what we've been doing. We're creating mirrors to help these young people tell their story, because they have a story as well, and it's all of us.
Now, if I can actually add to that, a lot of the young American Muslim audience tend to utilize music to tell their story and sometimes even vent their anger oftentimes. So they'll find rapping and music to sort of talk about what's going on with them. Though I do want to say, with music, you have to be very careful of making sure that you take the positive components of the music and not the negative one. I'm saying this from experience. I used to be a very big fan of Tupac Shakur. So if anybody called me a terrorist at that one moment, it would have been physical violence. just because there was so much anger built up on me. You know, I love Tupac and I still listen to some of his songs, you know, like Dear Mama. but I learned to sort of appreciate it and learn his story through his music without letting it anger me. And then every time someone leaves a wound, that I respond in a negative way.
Yeah, you got to teach navigation. We find a lot of young people that we end up getting, they like the music, and then they find themselves going perpetuating these acts that they're hearing in the songs. But if you can help them more appreciate it, of it just being a story being told and not something that you have to go out and act, you know, it's just music. It's poetry, you know, and not become it.
Where do you see the impact of what you're doing today? Where do you see Nashville looking like 10 years from now?
My hope is that 10 years from now, we pay attention much more to our character, like Dr. King said, rather than our physical appearance. I hope that 10 years from now, that we have much more well-educated elected officials who have the knowledge and the wisdom to lead our city. I hope that 10 years from now on, our education system would be world-class, you know, that teaches and becomes a source for young children to, even though they work locally, to be global thinkers. That's what I hope we will be in 10 years.
I hope in 10 years that because I do a lot of speaking and teaching and trainings and whatnot, I hope we have a lot of mini-me. When I say mini-me, clone, if that's what you want to call it, but mini-me. A lot of young people that have come through the group say that, I'd like to do what you do, Mr. Ron. And I always say this, you know, when we go out to the prison or to the juvenile facility, is imagine just being able to come in here and talk to you and get paid $1,000 to talk to you. And so the guys were like, you can get paid $1,000 to talk to people? Yes, if you could, you know, you get the education, you prepare, you put in the work. My hope is it's just like a wildfire. It takes a match to start the fire. I really do believe this. I just don't really hope, because we're seeing it. We're seeing young people make the transition and being change agents in their own community.
I think in 10 years that the contributor may very well be gone, but I think the hundreds of people who got off the streets using that income, it matters to all of them, and I think it matters to their friends and family members, and those that experience will live on through their experiences and the people that they touch. And I think that for all of the people that purchase the paper, millions, it's been over 5 million transactions at this point. It matters to each of those people that reached their hand out a window and met the person on the other side or met someone on a sidewalk. And for children who have grown up from a young age now knowing homeless people, knowing, yeah, I knew that man. And there's also elderly people that have never had the opportunity to speak to a homeless person. There was one of my favorite stories was a church secretary. Probably, I believe she was in her 70s. She was leaving the McDonald's drive-through. And she saw a vendor down at the end of the way on the sidewalk, and she said, oh, no, there's one of those people that my pastor told me I had to buy a paper from. So she prepares herself and says, okay, well, he's going to go for my purse. So she's like, I'm just going to unroll the window this much, and I'm going to stick the dollar out, and I'm going to get the paper, and I'm going to drive off. So she pulls up to him, unrolls the window a little more than an inch, and the vendor kind of crawls through the car halfway, opens the paper into her lap, and says, I've got a poem on page 9, and had autographed it for her. And she is shaking in her boots. But that woman in the second half of her life, you know, that changed her life. And so no matter what happens to the paper, I think the people that have had the excuse to dialogue on either side of that transaction, it changed for them, and it's going to change for the people that they interact with from this point.
Well, that was a really wonderful final question. So thank you. Thank you for being here. I hope you learned a lot. This is very inspiring and thought-provoking. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Movers and Thinkers is produced by Nashville Public Radio. Music is by the Easton Ellises, courtesy of the Free Music Archive. Our engineers are Tom Knox and Carl Peterson. Tony Gonzalez took photos, which are on the WPLN Facebook page. Anita Bug is the show's editor. In fact, the entire newsroom helped out, so thank you. And thanks to every listener who emailed me last time to give feedback or suggest a speaker. Please let me know what you think about this episode by emailing movers@wpln.org. Stay tuned to find out more about our next live event and podcast episode. Go to WPLN.org and click on Movers and Thinkers on the right side to sign up for our mailing list. I'm Emily Siner, and this is Nashville Public Radio.